Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is Damon Wilson, President and CEO of the National Endowment for Democracy, and I'm really honored to have all of you with us on our first Twitter Spaces conversation here at the Endowment on what is the one-year anniversary of the fall of Kabul, a time when many Afghans lost their freedom, many Afghan women lost their voice. We have a special guest with us today, Fawzia Koofi. I'm really delighted to have Fawzia on the line with us. She, of course, was the first female deputy speaker of the Parliament of Afghanistan. She was a former member of the peace negotiating team working with the Taliban and the author of a remarkable book, The Favored Daughter, A Woman's Fight to Lead Afghanistan into the Future. She's joining us from London in the midst of a transportation strike. Fawzia, thank you for making your way to be online with us. She is currently serving as a fellow at the Center for Strategic International Studies and a special partnership with the Carl Gershman Fund for Democrats at Risk here at the Endowment. For all of our listeners, just to underscore, Afghanistan is a major priority for the Endowment. Ned has been present in the country supporting civil society and independent media since 1984, the year after our own creation. During the difficult past year, we've been proud to stand by many of our partners and have helped evacuate 1,024 of our Afghan partners. But even more so, we're proud to have a very strong grants program that continues today in Afghanistan, supporting so many Afghans in civil society and the media. But Fawzia, let me turn to you. We're 1 year after the fall of Kabul. What is your assessment of the situation in Afghanistan?
Thank you so much, Damon, for having me in this conversation. Just to answer to the question about what is happening in Afghanistan now, I think, just to summarize, the Taliban have not been able to keep the promises and the narratives they have created for us, the promises they made to the U.S. During the Doha Agreement. I will highlight three main issues that the Taliban have not kept, which affects not only the people of Afghanistan, but our relations with the world. The first is the Taliban created a narrative that they will respect women's rights and human rights, that they have changed, that there are now Taliban 2.0. And in their generic statements and press releases and in the meetings with us during the negotiations, during the dialogues, they have said that a woman can go to school, can go to work, but within the principles of Islam. But we know in reality what they are doing is in the contrary to the principles of Islam, banning girls from going to school, women to access to resources and work. Also, the second promise they gave to internationals, especially to the Americans, was that they will disassociate with any military extremist groups, and they explicitly mention Al-Qaeda, but we know that, in fact, they haven't really disassociated themselves with Al-Qaeda, and we know that assassination of Al-Qaeda leader 2 weeks ago in Kabul, just a few meters or so from a palace, is just an indication of them not being honest on what they claim. And the third was that their commitment to engage in a peace process that will result to a political settlement respecting the rights and liberties of the people of Afghanistan, the institutions, protection of the institutions, and the gains we have had. We have invested blood and treasure over the last 20 years to achieve those gains. So in summary, I think Afghanistan has gone back to scratch to where Taliban were first time in power. And especially it has gone back to scratch when it comes to women and human rights.
Fawzia, say just another word about the situation for women in Afghanistan today. Everybody's seen the coverage of education for school girls, but share a little bit about the assessment of how you see things for women and girls in Afghanistan right now.
So, Damon, since Taliban took over, they have actually issued 28 verdicts and decree. And all of that is, in a way or the other, eliminating women's rights. So that means every 2 months, every month, there is a verdict or a decree or announcement or a position of Taliban eliminating women's rights. So from starting from the fact that last year in September 17th, they have issued their first decree banning girls beyond grade 6 from going to school. And their claim is that initially they said they will allow open girls school on the 23rd of March. On the 23rd of March, which was a tragic day, a national tragic day for everyone inside and outside the country, they literally returned students from their school's doorstep, saying that, you know, they are working on a uniform, which is strange because the uniform of students in Afghanistan have always been Islamic. They are fully covered, like many other Islamic countries. And then now they are saying that they are working on a curricula. Well, I mean, according to principles of Islam, education is compulsory for men and women. So in fact, they are misusing the religion to suppress women. From that verdict, which was last year in September 17, all the way to verdicts about women cannot get out and travel more than 75 kilometers without a male companion, which is actually very, very rare in other Muslim countries. Women are representative of their governments at the presidential level. They travel without any male companion. So to the fact that women cannot come to the offices, instead they should send their male companion. So we lost a lot of male breadwinners of the family during war. Now their women don't have any means of income. So in a word, in a sentence, I can say that Afghanistan nowadays look like an open prison for its women.
Bafazia, take me back to August 15th. Take me back to Kabul. Where were you when the Taliban entered Kabul? What were you doing and what happened in those days to you and your family?
August 15 was, of course, a day that nobody predicted that things will escalate the same way they did. Just before August 15, there was a lot of, kind of silence before storm, I would say. So, for instance, in the evenings, each night, electricity was cut for a few hours and there was a complete silence. And it would remind many people living in Kabul of the civil war or the Taliban first time power. I was in Kabul. I came from Doha because my own province, Badakhshan, located in northeast region of the country, literally most of it fall to the Taliban. And I felt no reason to negotiate with Taliban if I don't have the leverage of having a geography or representing a geography. So I came to Kabul to see how we can mobilize more forces and go back to Badakhshan, more political leaders, more people to support and regain the territory. So I was in Kabul basically when, in the morning of 15th of September, I know there is a lot of people in this conversation now in this space who were in Kabul and they probably recall the experience. We didn't know what's going to happen. There was, of course, a lot of propaganda in favor of Taliban that they have entered from north, they entered from south, from east. We knew something was happening, but we didn't know the extent of how it was happening. So everybody was basically out of their homes. They were trying to escape, but they didn't know where to escape. Probably we were escaping ourselves. We were escaping the moment that we were. We didn't have an aim to go, but we were just getting out of our homes. We were in several conversations with women rights activists in different groups. Because I was in the negotiation, they were asking questions about what happened. So interestingly, when I contacted one of the Taliban's negotiators about, what's going to happen, if they enter Kabul, how are they going to treat these women rights activists, civil society activists, journalists, people who were against Taliban, if not in a battlefield, but in a different battlefield, which is in the field of democracy, representing the voice of their people. I contacted one of the Taliban negotiators to see what's going to happen if they come. What is their strategy? Are they going to massacre everybody? Are they going to kill people, etc.? And his response was that, and the good thing is in technology, you can keep all the records. So I have still the record of him saying that, that we are not going to enter Kabul militarily. You will be coming. I mean, when he referred to me, I mean, the delegation that was supposed to go to Doha, led by senior leaders, including the former president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, the chief of High Peace Council, myself, and a few other members of negotiation. We were supposed to go to Doha and make the final round of negotiation with Taliban and have a deal. So this was something the Taliban negotiator was referring to. He said, you know, we are not entering Kabul militarily. So even some of the Taliban members didn't know that they are supposed to enter Kabul. I think they entered because the former president fled Afghanistan. So I think it was around 2 o'clock, more or so or less, that the news was already spreading around the city that the Taliban have really now entered and the former president and his team fled. By 4 o'clock, it was already out. We were at home. There was a lot of exchange of messages. People were running to the airport. Kabul was full of traffic. Nobody could even move. And then at 4 o'clock, it was confirmed that the former president fled and the tragic fall of Kabul began.
Fazia, thanks for sharing that. And what do you, I mean, was there a chance that the peace talks you were engaged in, did you see a pathway that they could have led to an alternative outcome? Why did they fail?
I think so. I mean, that was the hope and that was the reason we engaged in a peace negotiation, because I still believe that there is no way out of this crisis but a political settlement, because I think we have seen more than 4 decades of war. I know that, you know, people are pushed to the corner and some of the people are left with no choices to use military. But I think that at the end of this, we have to really talk politically and accept the coexistence. So yes, I was hoping that we will achieve something, at least a political settlement that is not satisfactory 50% or 100% to both sides. But I think even 40% satisfaction of all involved parties was still better than the total collapse. I think what went wrong, everybody talk about it, but being an insider and being in the room during negotiation, during the dialogue, etc., I think the major thing that you know, resulted the demoralization of our political and military forces was the fact that there was a deal with Taliban that put Taliban as an Islamic emirate of Afghanistan. And in the bracket, it says that the United States of America does not recognize them, but they were there in the agreement. And then, of course, the withdrawal, the way it happened. We're not saying that the American forces should have been in Afghanistan forever, but I think there was a proper way of withdrawing to ensure that the Afghanistan institutions and, you know, all the gains, as I said before, we have had were protected to some extent.
Indeed. And Fazia, can you share with us a little bit of your own journey? Tell us the days after August 15th. You originally did not plan to leave Afghanistan, but you have found yourself now in London, headed to the United States. Tell us a little bit about your own journey after August 15th.
My journey is a journey of, like many Afghans who either are inside Afghanistan or were forced to flee Afghanistan, is a journey of sorrow, tragedy, happiness. I think most of it is a journey of pain and sorrow and regrets. Last year, these days, I think we're all busy trying to get those people at immediate risk out of the country. I wasn't planning. I wasn't ready to leave my country. This was never my hope, my wish. My daughters were evacuated by the Americans. I have two daughters, and they were basically in a camp in Qatar. And I was receiving back-to-back messages that they need to be, you know, they need to leave this camp, go somewhere more permanent. And of course, as a mother, as a single mother, when you your primary responsibility is towards your own children, and if you are not able to protect your own children and provide them a space, especially if they are girl children, then the claim to protect other women and girls is, of course, baseless. Because how can you claim to protect others and defend their rights and amplify their voices if you cannot do that for your own daughters or your own children? So then, for the sake of my children, I decided to come, although I was under house arrest, and everyone knows that. And it was difficult to get out because I didn't want to be part of that evacuation the way it happened. It was a disgrace, I think, for most of the very dignified people who were part of the progress of their country. And I didn't, I wasn't evacuated the same way everybody was. Not that I, you know, I didn't, I wanted a protocol, but I just thought that it's not the appropriate way. So, that was one of the reasons I didn't want to leave. The second reason was, of course, I always wanted to be in my country. And the third reason was, that I wanted to prioritize others who were at risk. So I think it was like towards the last minutes of the evacuation that after a lot of negotiation with different organizations and the Taliban, that they formally allowed me to leave Afghanistan. It was an emotional day when I left to the airport. I still remember I have recorded video memos for myself. I still remember those emotional times when I left to the airport, although I knew that I would come back. But when I saw the airport, it was a completely functional airport. I came, in fact, using that airport VIP salon 3 weeks ago, probably. It was a proper airport. We were, we owned it and everything was working. There were professional people. But when I came, everything was broken. There was no system. It was full of garbage. And it was emotionally heartbreaking to see my country in that situation. I promised to myself, and in fact, I again have memo recorded for myself, that I would come back. And my plan was to go back like after 2-3 weeks. But the political complications of everything, especially Taliban attacking certain places, add to delay in my going back to Afghanistan until now.
Fazia, thank you for sharing that. I can only imagine the difficulty of those days. I'm headed to Calgary later today to meet several hundred of the Afghan partners that the endowment helped evacuate to Canada. And every single person has had just very difficult experiences. Thank you for sharing that. But take us back a little bit. Let's back up. How did this become your life? How did this become your trajectory? You have an open letter to your daughters in which you wrote that I always shared the family love of politics, but I never thought it would be the career I chose. I wanted an education. I wanted to be a doctor and heal people. I never wanted a life in politics, but it seems it was always going to be my destiny. So how did this become your path?
Well, as you indicated, it was not a path that I deliberately chose from my childhood, although I was a fighter, I would say, like many other Afghan women from childhood. I was the one inside the family standing against so many odds that otherwise it was regarded as a norm. I was the first girl in our family to go to school. My father was actually a member of parliament, and he established, as a member of parliament representing those remote areas, he established girls' school in our area, but he never allowed his own daughters. So after my father was also killed in a peace mission, then trying to negotiate with jihadi leaders, he was killed. We then had to move to the city, and I started going to school with my mother's support. And then I wanted to become a medical doctor, because then all the top students who were top students at the school would usually end up being in medical college. So I was in the medical college for first year during the Civil War. After the Taliban came first round, like thousands of other Afghan women, I was also banned from going to school. And then after the Taliban were removed from power, then I continued my work as a if not politician in 2001, but as an activist. It was actually during the first time of Taliban that injected the seed of getting to politics in my mind. And that was when I saw Taliban were like, the way they were whipping people in the streets, the way they were denying people from their basic rights. I thought this is wrong. Something has to change. And obviously, what they do, especially in many occasions, also trying to name it Islam is not Islam. So I tried to come to politics to make it more a humanized way of doing things, not just, a means of power, but a humanized way of trying to deliver and making it look like politics is also a game or a profession that normal human being could go. So in 2005, then I ran for parliament for the first time.
In 2001, you had this back to school campaign. Tell us a little bit about how that sort of laid the foundation for much of your work.
Yeah, in 2001, when the Taliban government was removed from power or fall down, then there was like thousands of Afghan girls, but also boys that did not have the chance, the opportunity. They were not allowed to go to school. So we started a major campaign called Back to School, and we set up temporary tents across Afghanistan. I was with UN on that time, providing temporary schooling for Afghan girls and boys. And I was proud to be part of that in terms of providing support to the schools, to the Ministry of Education, traveling with teachers to the remote areas and villages, and seeing girls going back to school with their black and white uniform. Those were, I think, golden days for the people of Afghanistan. Now, yes, there were American forces, NATO allies, etc. But I think many people were highly hopeful about their future and the way, you know, they were liberated from some of those oppressions, that they did not realize, you know, who has helped achieve that liberation, I would say. Because they were so happy, women, men, everybody, those were like happy, momentous days, I would say, for everybody. And just to add, we supported like millions of girls back to school. And initially, probably in some areas in Afghanistan, in some remote areas, the families were opposing, not allowing their females, their female members of the family, their daughters, their sisters to go to school. But eventually, I think even in the remote, very conservative areas of Afghanistan, people wanted their daughters to go to school. So this was a societal transformation that not many people talk about it. It's a societal transformation that does not get media attention, because what we get in media is either, you know, suicide bombing, rocket attacks, number of people that are killed, or the number of schools that are built, or health clinic, and all about these kind of hard, tangible measurables. While I think one of the things that cannot be measured is that societal transformation, the fact that regardless of people living where, which part of Afghanistan, they wanted to be part of the progress of their nation.
And Fawzia, take me back as well. You've shared that your father, also a member of parliament, he was assassinated. He was killed when you were 4 years old, I believe. You've also had threats to your own life. You know the pain of this pathway. Why do you think, despite those types of direct personal threats to your life, that you found the determination to speak out, the determination to play this role? And how does that reflect on the women of Afghanistan today who are still willing to turn out on the streets of Kabul or Helmand Province in a protest? Help us understand a little bit of that, knowing that pain, that threat, what motivates people like yourself?
Well, we have a proverb in my language, in Farsi, which says, the more a glass is broken into pieces, the sharper those broken pieces are. So the more depressed and oppressed and pushed to the corner the people of Afghanistan, but especially the women of Afghanistan are, the more passionate they become about, you know, their rights, about what they want to be. Because I think most of them know that what's happening to them has no base. No religious base, no political base. It's rather, basically, maybe it is a political decision. It has no base in religion, because the religion we represent is about education. It's about coexistence. It's about tolerance. And what some of the Taliban leaders, and most of them actually now, try to represent is not our religion. So I think that's why, understanding this dynamic, women of Afghanistan have tried to stand tall for protecting their rights. In my case, I think the need for me to, and thousands of other women like me, to contribute. There are days also being abroad. When I wake up in the morning, there are some very low moments as well, because we are human beings. We also have mental health. We also have our own issues. I also have my own vulnerabilities. But as a politician, it's interesting, because the expectation is all as an activist that we should always be, you know, happy to the standard. We should not have our vulnerability. We should not express it, because otherwise it will demoralize people. But I'm being honest that we also have very low days, very low moments, undergo very difficult moments, especially, you know, when the anniversary happened. Every minute of 15, 16, 17 August until now, it reminds me of something at that time happened in Afghanistan, especially or particularly, and how we could avoid it. How there were chances that we could avoid it to stop being where we are now. So all of those, you know, vulnerabilities that I have, sometimes it gives me also reasons. Like in my low moment, when I receive a call from somebody inside Afghanistan expecting me to do something, that expectation comes from a hope, from the fact that they believe in us. And that belief gives me the power to do something. I think women of Afghanistan are in the age of making history. They are the natural resistance for the progress of their country against oppression. I think they will, although small in numbers, but their message and their resistance and their, you know, standing tall against all the security challenge is important. The number probably in case of Afghanistan is not important.
Fawzia, I love the way you capture the women of Afghanistan are sort of the natural resistance against oppression, the natural bulwark for progress. And I thank you for sharing as well your own feelings. I think as a political voice, a political leader, it's important that people understand the humanity here, because after all, that's what you're fighting for, is human dignity for individuals. So what does that mean about your work now? You're in London, you're hoping to come to the United States. How do you see your ability to contribute? How do you see your work going forward?
What we focus now, along with my other friends, sisters, brothers, is to, first of all, to still struggle for a political process. I know this is not an attractive word anymore. I know when I say this, a lot of people would raise their eyebrows and say, well, do you really expect Taliban with all what they do is to accept the fact that there is only way forward, and that's a political process for which we can establish a legitimate government that is representative of the diversities of Afghanistan, including the women. So that is one of the major focus still. And for that, I, along with my other sisters, try to see how we can bring unity and mobility, mobilize more political forces who are in exile, but those who are also inside Afghanistan, because we need to be one united. There is one Taliban and there is the opposition forces. In opposition forces, we cannot afford to be divided. We were divided inside the country. We must let that division be there in Kabul. And the time we left Afghanistan, we must, you know, let everything be in Afghanistan. Our disunity and the reason for fragmentation, they must be there. We should not bring it with ourselves. It's time for us to unite. We must bear all, you know, that this unity there. And then the second thing is amplifying the voices of women in my conversation with policymakers, you know, think tanks outside the country, in regional country, and those who can influence Taliban, but also amplifying the voices of women with the politicians and with, you know, in all the interventions. And that's why we have tried to create several platforms in which we could amplify those voices.
So, Fawzia, what about your time in the peace negotiations and interacting with the Taliban? What insights did you gain from the Taliban leadership that help inform why you think there might be a political path forward? What did you learn from your experience of negotiating with the Taliban?
I would divide briefly the engagement time with Taliban in two phases. The first phase was the dialogue period, when before they signed an agreement with Americans. They seem to be more open, accessible, they demonstrated more willingness for a political settlement that Taliban one part of it, but the rest of the political community and civil society and women other parts of it. However, after they signed the deal officially with Americans and we started the official meetings, like the actual negotiations, I have realized, and I think many other members of negotiation noticed, that Taliban are less accessible, they are not meaningfully engaging in the negotiations, and they are expediting the war on Afghanistan. I think what I have learned, that initially Taliban thought that we are, as women, we are included in the negotiation because it looks nice from American side and from European side. It's according to the Western standard that women should be included, and that we are a token and that we do not have knowledge, political knowledge. But I think after a lot of engagement in conversation, sometimes We were four women, and sometimes there was only one woman in the negotiation in the room. We have engaged ourselves and tried to present ourselves in a way that we were the representative of the new generation, the last 20 years, diverse Afghanistan and transformed Afghanistan. And to that extent, I realized that my knowledge, I mean, I'm not saying as me, but the woman knowledge, their experience of updated government and the way the government works, their experience about the world politics was much more updated than the Taliban. And I think over time, some of the Taliban negotiators realized this. And that way, I think we managed to create some respect of ourselves among the Taliban negotiators, I must say that. Because initially, they were not even, some of them were not even ready to look at us in our eyes. We were, of course, insisting to make ourselves visible because we were hoping that there is a political settlement. If I had known then that Taliban are going to go back to their policies of zero location when they were, I have never tried that effort because it didn't really help change the status quo. But then we really made all of our efforts to make ourselves visible and represent not only the women of Afghanistan, but the country as a whole. So we had, as women negotiators, we had major responsibility to represent our country and to the women of Afghanistan.
Fawzia, I know you've got two daughters. Can you share with us what your thoughts are about your daughter's future and what kind of Afghanistan, they might be able to visit one day if you look out into the future? What's your prognosis if you look out into the future for Afghanistan?
Well, my daughters have grown up with all the values that I have raised them with. Even if I didn't share those values, they have grown up with that. Fighter, passionate, graceful, cautious of their country and the problem of their people. And grown up with values. In fact, sometimes my daughters are questioning some of the Taliban, but others' principles of their behavior towards women. And I see there is a lot of logic, and they are the representative of the new generation of Afghanistan. And this is something I try to express to Taliban, that Afghanistan, a new generation of well-equipped with knowledge, access information. They have grown up with storm of knowledge and information. It's difficult to handle them the same way that you have been handling the nation before 2001, because they know how to inform the world about their life, about their status, and that's what we are experiencing. I would not tell my daughters what to do. They want to have their professional life. But I think, like me, maybe probably destiny will bring them to politics. You never know.
Your daughters sound like remarkable young women. Fawzia, thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us, with our audience today. We're really honored to have you with us. We look forward to welcoming you in the United States. This is Damon Wilson on behalf of the National Endowment for Democracy, America's Foundation for Freedom. We are proud partners of the people of Afghanistan, and we're honored to have had you with us today, Fawzia. Thank you so much for signing on from London. Final word to you, Fawzia.
Thank you, Damon. I wish you all the best with your engagement in Canada with the Afghans with whom you worked and helped to leave Afghanistan. I think there are still a lot of people in Afghanistan who would like to leave, who are, the circumstances in a way for them to leave. But I think let's make Afghanistan a safer place, all of us, with all of our efforts, a better place so that everybody could go back and participate meaningfully in a reconstruction of the country, because it's a country that has unique situation. It's a country that could connect Southeast Central Asia. It's a country full of natural resources, the youngest nation in the world. So all those potentials that Afghanistan has, let's utilize them for the better of the region and the world.
Thank you for helping close us out on a dose of optimism. We go to bed every night thinking about not only our partners who remain in Afghanistan, but the 28 million people there who really deserve a brighter future. And it's because of the work of people like you, Fawzia, that I'm confident one day that will be the case. So thank you so much. Thanks for being with us. And thanks to all of our followers who are with us on Twitter Spaces. Signing off for the endowment, this is Damon. Cheers.